This is a podcast from ABC Overnights. Here's Trevor Chappell.
Dr. Richard Barker is an adjunct fellow at the Institute of Sport, joins us this morning. Good morning, Richard.
Good morning. How are you, Trevor?
Good, Richard. Firstly, we've just been talking about surfing and the relationship to the 1956 Olympics. Can you add anything to that?
No, I've heard a little bit, something about, you know, there was a connection there. Of course, there was no Bell's Beach at that time of year, but the American surfers were, coming out, and surfing's just got into the Olympics, by the way, for Tokyo, but I'm not sure that our television was starting up for the 56 games, so there was connections with the U.S. with the war. So anyways, I'm not that familiar with exactly what the surfing connection was.
Do you know, Richard, one of the things, the reason that I wanted to talk about this was we were talking about the 56 Olympics and how it was that firstly, Melbourne, but Australia got to be involved because we were the first country in the Southern Hemisphere to actually have them.
Yes.
And was it a big deal?
Oh, yeah, it was because we were up against Buenos Aires, and South America never had it either, and we won the final vote in the fourth round, 21-20. So the IOC was prepared to get the games and their voting delegates to take it away from usually the North America or from Europe where the games were primarily held. So it was a big deal. It was the first time ever, and the vote was very close. There's a lot of cities involved, and so it was a big deal, yes.
What was the reason that they didn't want to have it in the Southern Hemisphere?
Oh, there's complicated reasons. A lot of it's to do with just the seasons, because when you have the games in the Southern Hemisphere, you've got to look at the weather and our sporting calendar. So Melbourne games were in November, December, which is outside of the Northern Hemisphere's primary season. So for things like track and field and swimming and the athletes and their training programs, it really was a seasonal thing. It really wasn't. And it was so far away, too. In both cases, the travel was very difficult for the athletes, and the numbers of athletes competing were down in the end. But they were scared to get away because the primary reason for travel is that there aren't jets as there are now, and it takes a long time to get there and expensive once they get the teams there, too.
Was the process similar to what we know of today, where there is a vote and there is a whole lot of lobbying and that sort of stuff went on?
Yes, they do lobbying, and I was at the Sydney Olympics and got to see some of the bid cities where they go into a fancy hotel and they set up their lobbying. It wasn't as extensive back then. Of course, they weren't spending billions of dollars. Back then, we had to spend hundreds of thousands of pounds, and there was a tripartite sponsorship from the Commonwealth government, the state government, the city of Melbourne. But the funds weren't as high as they are now, and they didn't do all the infrastructure, building new freeways and subways to the extent. But it still was a, as you mentioned, a big deal, and it was difficult because of the logistics of getting it so far away from the main countries.
Because it would have been expensive at that time as well to be able to fund it, and I understand that there were problems with funding.
Yes, they argued back and forth. The Commonwealth government didn't want to do anything. There was an argument as well about what stadium to use, and that caused a real political uproar. They looked at the showgrounds, and they looked at the MCG, and they toed and froed, and then they came back, and the Commonwealth government said use the MCG, and it had to be refurbished because it was a cricket and football ground, so that had to be converted to have a track to it. So there was there was money involved in all those things. So it was controversial at the time as to where the stadium was going to be, and it was interesting. And of course, the MCG is such an iconic structure, and I'm glad it was there because it's left a great legacy.
That was, wouldn't you have thought before they decided to nominate or put Melbourne forward as a possible venue for the Olympics that they would organise the funding before they actually did that?
Yeah, now they have to. Now they have to have a guarantee. They have to have a letter from the funding authorities, which are usually the national governments and the state governments and cities, that they'll guarantee it. So before the bids go in and are accepted, that has to be part of the bid process now, which has become very convoluted. secluded, you know, very organized. They have candidature cities that are selected from a list, although the number of cities are diminishing because of public backlash. Just recently, Calgary, that hosted the Winter Olympics, everyone thought, oh, they'll go ahead because they got the infrastructure, and the people voted against it, and it follows a line of cities that have withdrawn from the Games recently, from the bid process, Oslo, a number of others. So it's interesting.
Richard, does that mean that there was a sort of Olympic committee before we actually won the Games, that there was a committee of people that had something to do with the Olympics in Australia?
Yes, there is. There's always got to set up a bid committee, which is sort of set up, tries to get the Games, organizes, you know, its funding. Back then it wasn't as organized as it is now, but with key people, Sir Frank Beaurepaire, of course, the famous Beaurepaire family, and he was involved with the bid process, and a number of others, of course, a lot of Victorians that were on the Victorian Olympic Council, which is a state arm of the Australian Olympic Committee. So, you know, they have to organize this bid committee with different people involved, and, you know, they have to work a long time because the bid's usually 7 years in advance, although just recently for Paris and L.A., they changed it and took two Olympic Summer Games at once, which they've really never done before. Mm. But that shows you that the number of bid cities were down, and they didn't want to lose Los Angeles and Paris, so they've nominated them as the next two.
Richard, was this the first time that we had tried to get a Games in Australia?
It's the first time that I'm aware of.
Yeah.
Of course, we had the World War II intervene there, and the Games weren't held for quite a few years, and prior to that, you know, the Games weren't quite at the level, but starting in 52, when the Soviets came in, the Games in Helsinki took a new, you know, a new approach, because the Cold War was involved, and there was television now, and it was a new era, so, you know, it really was, as I like that term, it was a big deal.
That's a big deal. We'll come back, we'll just take some calls. Hello, Lorna. What do you remember?
Well, I was attached to North Narrabeen Surf Club when I was in my teens, and five of us got together, decided to go to the Australian Championships down at Torquay, and at the same time we booked in to see some of the events at the Olympic Games, so it was a double whammy for us, and we had a pretty good time down there.
What did you go and see?
We went to the opening ceremony, which was very, very emotional because the Hungarians had just had big problems in their country, and most of the spectators were in tears when the team marched into the stadium. We went to the basketball. We went to the hockey. Swimming was booked out, of course. We went to the athletics. We saw Betty Cuthbert win her medals.
Wonderful.
And after the opening ceremony was over, they'd left the gate open at the marshalling yard at the back of the stadium. And, of course, it wouldn't happen these days. We just all trooped in with our cameras and took photos and got autographs of all the competitors. It was pretty wild. It was wonderful.
And then
we actually hitchhiked down to Torquay to see the Australian surf titles.
Thank you, Lorna. We'll stick with the Olympics for now. Richard, that issue between Hungary and Russia was one of the reasons that there were boycotts leading up to this game. So I didn't realise there were boycotts.
Oh, yeah. Even though these were called the Friendly Games and they deserved the title, there was this big undercurrent of the Cold War and issues with boycotts. So there was actually sort of three of these. The big one was the Hungarian invasion, and as a result of that, the Hungarians came still, and there were Netherlands, Cambodia, Spain, Switzerland all withdrew. And then the second was the Suez Crisis, where Egypt, Lebanon, and Iraq withdrew. That was due to the invasion of Egypt, which nationalized the canal. And the third one, which was interesting, was the People's Republic of China, as a communist nation, came to Melbourne, brought their team, and were so upset that the Republic of China, which is Taiwan, were there, they just picked up their team and officials and left.
So they came here to start with and then left.
Yeah, they came, which people didn't know they came, but they said the sight of the Republic of Taiwan's flag or Republic of China's flag was so upsetting that they didn't even compete. And then they bowed out and didn't come back till Los Angeles in 1988 afterwards in Seoul. So they were here. So there were several boycotts. The big one was this Hungarian invasion, though, but the Soviet teams came and the Hungarian teams came, and of course the big battle in the water polo where there was supposedly blood in the water, and they had to get, there was lots of controversy over that, but the Hungarians won the game and went on to win the gold medal. They were so strong in that sport.
That was interesting, though, that there were countries that went out in support, but both countries still competed.
Yes, that's what's fascinating. You wonder you know, you really wonder about that. Why the Hungarians would come, for example. He must have been just in such a bad way with the invasion and all the issues associated with that.
Now, and then some of them defected as well.
Yes, some of the athletes defected, which happens in, you know, during the Sydney Olympics that happened here and in various countries, you get defections occurring. And I was talking to some people about it, and, you know, there's some of the athletes defected. And interesting home basis for water polo emerged in Victoria as a result of that, because the Hungarians were so strong in that sport, which isn't a major sport in Australia.
Nan joins us. Hello, Nan.
I was only 9 years of age, but my father was a country policeman, and that was the other lady mentioned security. And the way they did it, they seconded a whole lot of country policemen down to Melbourne, and I was lucky enough, my mother put me on the train from Wodonga, and I went down and I spent a couple of days with him in Melbourne, and I went to water polo and some athletic events, and it was just wonderful.
Look, thank you, Nan. When you take, because it was also when you take a look at where the events were in Victoria, it was quite spread out and included regional areas, Richard.
Yes, it did. Yeah, Lake Windery in Ballarat was one. I went and saw the site. It was, quite a few years later, and it kind of was a little bit, you never imagined they could have Olympic Games there, but it was a fantastic regional site. I live in Williamstown, and there was shooting here in Williamstown, in one of the suburbs here, and, spread out. Of course, Olympic Park was the big area. The MCG was the highlight, and all those venues that were there with Olympic Park have been updated tremendously in the modern time with, Amy Stadium and a number of others where the Collingwood Football Club is. But back then, the swimming pool was there and Olympic Park Stadium, and those are gone. So the MCG is the only one left, but they also are at the Royal Exhibition Grounds and Prince Philip Bay for sailing. So they used, regional areas for which they do for a lot of the Olympics and Commonwealth Games.
One of the things, though, you talk about how they were able to utilise existing venues, one thing that you can't really utilise an existing venue for is the Olympic Village. How did they go with that?
Well, Heidelberg was chosen for it, and of course, after the games are over, you get successful Olympic villages, and you get some that aren't so successful. Usually, in the modern era, they develop it, put condominiums or townhouses in there, and people buy it after, and they actually make money. But the Heidelberg one, post games, there was a complaint that it was a bit far from the action. And Olympic villages in Sydney, I was there, of course, and people will note that the village was right there, out in Homebush. So, it caused a few issues. They said it was too far from the actions, far from the CBD, whereas a lot of the other venues in Melbourne, which made it a great 56-game city, and in future, if we ever could have it, which is controversial, it would be great because things would be very centralized. So where would the village be in future Olympics? Probably more centralized with a private consortium involved to sell it off. But Heidelberg, after, ran into some difficulties, was never a really... that particular Olympic village wasn't as successful as some other Olympic villages have been.
George, good morning.
I was born in 1940, and so I was 16 at the time of the Games, and my parents lived at Ermington in Sydney, and the house backed onto Ryde Parramatta Golf Course, and I always remember in the late afternoons after the golfers had finished, there was Betty Cuthbert out on the fairway sprinting up and down, training all on her own. She'd sprint up and sprint down, and in the gathering darkness of the late afternoons, her parents owned a nursery up on Victoria Road, and that's where she lived. But I still remember that very well. That was the extent of her training, a bit different to today's training methods.
Wasn't she the darling of Australian athletics?
She was, and that she made a name that year, didn't she, at the Olympics? That was where she first hit the spotlight.
Yeah, Richard?
Yeah, she was one of the fantastic athletes. Betty Cuthbert, Shirley Strickland, of course, in athletics, and the women were very dominant. And, of course, swimming, where we took a lot of medals with, the Murray Rose and also Dawn Fraser. So, yeah, we were a force then. Third place overall, our best Olympics ever, with swimming and athletics providing a lot. And as our guest has just called up with the women sprinters, just giving us a tremendous boost.
Kev, good morning.
I'd just like to comment about the equestrian events being held in Stockholm in Sweden. That was actually contrary to the Olympic Charter. And the reason they were held there, of course, was because Australia's very stringent security by security laws would have let the horses being brought into the country. So the Olympic Committee actually broke their own rules by letting them being held in Stockholm.
Well, yeah, they had to do something because the quarantine laws there were very strict, and it was going to cause issues because the horse had to be so long in the country. Of course, they've changed it now, and I believe now the quarantine includes the time overseas. So that's, and all the horses that come out for the Melbourne Cup, you know, don't have to go through such strict guidelines. But back then, that was the compromise. It was one small thing. They held them in Stockholm in June before then, and the games were, it was interesting, Prince Philip, the Duke of Edinburgh, open our games, but the Queen never came out, and she did attend Stockholm and went there because it was close to England, of course. But it was a compromise. It wasn't the best situation equestrian, especially from Australia's perspective. We won a lot of medals in that sport. Couldn't be held on our host grounds, but it was a compromise.
You know, when we take a look at the lighting of the urn and how elaborate they've become, I love the photo of Ron Clark basically standing there with the lighter, lighting it up.
Yes, and of course he became a gun athlete after that. He was fairly young then. Burnt himself, I understand, during that process. And, yeah, it's always, I don't know if you remember Atlanta, when Muhammad Ali was involved in the shooting of arrows into one Olympics. And they've really come up with some amazing ways to open the games.
Oh, of course, at the Sydney Olympics, where everyone was terrified that little ramp was going to stop.
Yes, there was a fantastic opening ceremonies, and you just never know. They come up with really unique ideas, and you wonder what they're going to do, and they usually keep it a secret. Somebody manages to usually get a hold of what's going to happen because they have shows beforehand that are mock shows, but it's always fascinating to see how they're going to do it.
Hello, Paul.
In the late 60s, I went to RMIT. I was doing a TV course, and our studio practice, we had... If you guys probably remember seeing the old films where there was a camera with a 60-inch lens for close-ups, right? And that belonged to Channel 7. And years after, they donated it to RMIT, and we used to use that camera for studio practice at RMIT.
Yeah.
For television purposes, yeah.
You know, this was the other big thing about those games. I remember broadcasting-wise, it was enormous for radio and for television, Richard.
Yes. Yeah, it was sort of the new era, the start of it all. Of course, now the Olympics get a lot of their money from the TV broadcasting, and they even control when events start. For example, if they're not in the North American, especially time zones, then they try and put finals on at times that aren't suitable for the local audience, but suits that television one. So it's changed a lot. And 56, of course, was the start. I think it was the games after 56, finally in Rome, there was international broadcasts were available, and that was the first time. But it was starting to occur already in 1956, and that ramped us up here to get television here in Australia, of course.
Yeah, that was how we first started broadcasting, and that was really important that we be able to do that, because I presume there was going... Now, were they able to broadcast live, or was it done...
No, it wasn't done live then. I'm not sure about here in Australia how many people had televisions, but they weren't live until 1960. That's when they first kicked in.
But it would have been important for people in the States to be able to get it and be able to get relatively quick, I would thought, broadcasting in the States.
Yeah, it would have been taped. Like, even to this day, NBC, which has gotten most of the television coverage in the United States over the years of winning the broadcast rights, even they show things taped. They'll show a highlights package, and the American audiences complain because they can stream and get it live. So that's why they, they try to control when the final's on, because everyone wants live in this day and age. They don't want taped. So, but they would have not had live the same way that we have it now, of course.
It's a lovely story. Someone said, I heard that the 6 o'clock closing times had to be relaxed in Melbourne for the pubs.
Oh, wow.
Because it was considered that we were very unsophisticated if the pubs closed at six.
Yeah, and of course, Melbourne now has got a record of having clubs that are open 24/7. So it's changed dramatically. I got here in 1979 and I missed the 6 o'clock swill arriving from Canada. I didn't know what this 6 o'clock swill was. And now, of course, you can go anytime virtually and have a drink.
David, good morning.
Well, I had dinner with my Murray Rose in 68. No, actually, a couple of years after I left school, 72, because he went to Cranbrook like I did. And we had a dinner for all the previous swimming champions, and he spoke well and still had his looks. He said that his swimming, when he was in the pool after quite a few laps, that was his psychologist. He came out pretty straight after that.
Yeah.
Sort of thing, yeah. Exercise, which they're all promoting to get everybody feeling good. But in 68, if I can mention a very rare Australian Olympic, well, he got a bronze, so he wasn't a champion as such in fencing, but he was one of the very few in less than 10 in 100 years who competed in four Olympic Games in two classifications, pentathlon and fencing. Fencing where he got the bronze, and he didn't get any medal for the pentathlon, but he did nevertheless compete in four games, which is pretty amazing.
Oh, that's incredible. And we've seen people do that in water polo and all sorts of things. But thank you. Was it a great... I would think it was a great opportunity for a large Australian team to be able to compete as well, Richard.
Yes, we have a history of summer games and having large teams. And, of course, on your home front, you are advantaged by the fact that any team sports, you get an automatic entry, so you don't have to qualify. So in basketball and water polo and others, if you haven't qualified on the world scene, you still get an entry. So that brings up the numbers when you have a home Olympics. And of course, you're in your home environment. Melbourne athletes could have even stayed in their own homes. They wouldn't have had to, you know, have quite the low. Although everyone likes to stay in the village. Your numbers end up very high when it's a home game. We have a tradition, though, even of the games outside of Australia, of sending large teams.
Richard, was it an Olympics where there are a lot of records broken?
There weren't that many records broken. You know, the pool had a few, and track and field athletics had two, I believe it was. But there weren't a lot of world records broken, as you saw in other Olympics. And I was thinking about this last night, and I'm thinking probably because of maybe the disruption of their schedules, that they were outside of their main seasons, that they have traveled so far. I just was trying to pinpoint why there weren't as many world records broken. It was just prior to the era, although the Soviets were in the scene, and later there would be the East Germans and other Soviet bloc athletes. I think it was just prior to all the heavy drug usage. So, you know, that, of course, caused issues many years later and still isn't resolved.
Good for us, though.
Well, good for us. We were known as a nation that was very successful, very small, based on sort of natural talent, and our weather was fantastic. And starting in the 60s, and then we started to win, you know, Davis Cups and golf champions, and Nagel and so many others. And we were actually highlighted in an American magazine called Sports Illustrated in the 60s, because where is this nation, Australia? Where do they get all their athletes from? And included in that analysis was like a two-part issue. It's quite famous. And in there, they try to, you know, look at the reasons why we could produce so many champions. And Olympics was a major part of that story.
Marion, good morning, Marion.
Hi, Trevor.
Yes.
In that year of the Olympics, Stahl High School had a teacher there, Merv Lincoln, who was running.
Oh, yes.
And we had a train go down to Melbourne with the whole school the day he ran in his heat. And that was a day of athletics. And we had a wonderful time. And, of course, you can imagine when he went on, the scream that went up from the school.
When you say a wonderful time, how was it a wonderful time?
Oh, well, we were country kids and we were at the MCG and it was the Olympics.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, what chance were we going to have under normal circumstances?
So, Richard, I mean, first of all, I heard you go, yes, yes.
Yes, well, Merv Lincoln was quite well noted, along with our other athletes, and had a and people. I hear stories about things that have just been mentioned by our guest. And I was married. You know, when I first got married, I was with my brother-in-law's family, and they were talking about I teach Olympics and do this stuff. And they brought out these slides of the 56 games, and they had attended events at the MCG and saw the parades that they had associated with the Olympics. And I said, "Can I have those slides, please, for my teaching purposes?" So you hear stories like our last guest of, and it was much easier to get tickets back then. Like now, if you go on the Australian Olympic Committee's website, they're selling tickets to Tokyo now, and you have to, you know, spend a fair bit of money, and it wasn't as easy accessible as it was. And although the attendance was was very high, even though the tickets weren't as in high demand. Attendance was very high for the Melbourne Games.
I just think it's wonderful that country people were able to come in, see people competing, catch buses and trains and come into town and maybe stay the night, but then probably go back home as well.
Yes, and of course, train travel, was a major way of getting in. The CBD, isn't the best place to come and park, probably even back in 56. Being able to come in from the country, and that's what the Olympics try to do, is regionalize some things. Or they might have training grounds. Now, national teams that come in ahead of the Olympics will go to regional areas and go to a university or sports complex and train in an area. And sometimes it's not just in the main city. They'll go outside where it's cheaper, and they'll get quite an audience when they go to these areas.
I actually got a few people sending texts saying that my uncle was the first person in the street to get a TV, and everyone gathered around my grandparents' house to watch the Olympics. Another one saying the church nearest bought a television and the children would go and watch the Olympics on television after school. So it was really big for people as far as TV was concerned.
Yes, because that was the starting point for us. Color TV didn't come in until later, so it was all black and white. And I remember I was very young. I think I was 5 years old when the Melbourne Olympics. I don't remember seeing anything, even tape, but I did watch Rome shortly after, and I just remember our black and white television in our house, and we had just got it, in the 50s, in the mid to late 50s.
Daryl, good morning.
Good morning, Trevor.
Yes, Daryl.
Yeah, I'm just looking at a book here called The Olympic Games Melbourne 1956, and it's a day-by-day breakdown of every day of the Games and what events were held, who won them, etc. And it's about 144 pages, and there's 16 full-colour pages in there, and the rest are black and white photos, and at the end it has a breakdown of all the gold, silver and bronze medal winners. And that's been in the family for as long as I can remember.
There would have been so many things like that, Richard, that have been passed down, programs, tickets, all sorts of things.
Yes, and that book that the gentleman just mentioned, I have a copy of that. Somebody gave it to me, and it's unbelievable. It's a real collector's item. I'm not sure if you go on sport memorabilia how much it'll be worth, but it's a real collector's item.
Good on you. Thank you, Daryl. I don't think you'll be giving it away too quickly. Judith, good morning.
Good morning. I was 16 and I went to the Melbourne Olympics quite a few days, and I have wonderful memories. May I tell you about three of them?
Yeah.
I saw Betty Cuthbert win both the 100 and 200 races, and the opening ceremony with all the pageantry and everything, and Ron Clark lighting the torch where he burnt his arm and everything. That didn't come out later. And the funniest one, I was working at the time, and my girlfriend and I got a half a day off before the final closing ceremony, and they had the nation's its sport. So they had a VFL match between two amateur teams. And one of the captains was Dennis Cordner, who captained Melbourne, which was our VFL team. And he got a free kick paid against him. And we booed. Two little girls sitting up in one of the stands, and we booed. And the TV cameras swung around onto us. And we were on national television and the national news, and we were so embarrassed.
So it's you that started the whole booing thing, Judith?
I think it may have been.
So we'll blame you.
Yeah, well, I was used to going to the MCG. I'd been there every year, every Melbourne game since 1948, and I still barrack for them, even though I live in Brisbane.
Judith, thank you. There's quite often an exhibition sport or a couple with the Olympics. What were the exhibition ones for this one, Richard?
Yeah, one was Aussie Rules, yep. Which was had kind of a controversy. They got two teams, and one was, because they had the professionals versus the amateur side. And there's a great paper. One of my colleagues, Dr. Rob Hess, who's been on your show before, has written an entire paper about the demonstration sports and all the issues that could happen with that. And the second one was baseball, which is was in the Olympics and got taken out, and now some of it's back in again. So, yeah, they were the two that were held, which was a little bit unusual. You never usually try to put demo sports on that will be in future games or have a chance of it, but we knew Aussie Rules was never going to get in, but still was our demonstration sport along with baseball.
Baseball got in, so why couldn't Aussie Rules go in?
No, yeah, that's, well, I don't, just there aren't enough countries to go in, because when they, the recent voting for Tokyo saw surfing come in, which is great for us, skateboarding, which I think we're pretty good at, sport climbing, which isn't, you know, it's a sport that I'm not that familiar with, but you have to have so many nations involved worldwide before the IOC will consider it, and there's a long process to get into the games, and, you know, some sports might eventually be eliminated due to lack of interest, or that there's too much drug-ridden issues in the sport, but yeah, we're, Aussie Rules was a demo sport, but sometimes they did have sports that were just in the Olympic history that were just indigenous to that country. So that's where we got in, and I thought it was a good choice.
Yeah. Hello, Maureen.
Hi. I was there at the opening ceremony, and it was so, when you think about the big spectaculars, we only had the military marching bands for performing. That was all it was, you know.
Oh, this is with the opening. How big was the opening ceremony, Maureen?
Oh, well, it was, we got there very early. We had tickets, but we got there early in case there were queue jumpers, but everyone behaved themselves. The other thing, too, was I lived in Preston, and that's on the train line to the Jolimont station's on, and I was teaching at the time, and we used to get out early, so I used to run down to the station and catch the train into Jolimont, and we used to pick up tickets as people were leaving. We'd pick up tickets and we'd go sort of in for a, we'd get there about 4 o'clock or a quarter to four or something, and we'd get in until after six when they were still, you know, before they finished, because it was still light then. And we went on the first Saturday of the Games. They hadn't sold all the tickets, so they were advertising on the ABC, if you want to come and see the Olympic Games, you can't go to the MCG and you'll get in, and we did. The other thing I've just remembered while I was waiting was that I've got two records here somewhere of the ABC's broadcasting of the opening of the Olympics and the closing ceremony.
Oh, I remember Earl Reeve was one of the people that did the broadcast for it.
Yeah, well, I just remembered when the bloke was talking about the book he had.
Hmm.
But somewhere I've got these records. I must look them out. I don't know whether I'd play now, because I don't know whether my record player works.
Actual record. Oh, so you meant actual records. Richard, the ABC was important to the broadcasting of the Games.
Yes, and there always is a host broadcaster, and now they're very involved with the bid process, and they provide all the infrastructure. So other broadcasters come, but it's the host country that provides the infrastructure and the cameras and the cranes and everything attached to that. So, and that was just the early starts of it. And of course, then there's the money that the IOC and the host city organizing committee gets from the broadcast. So, yeah, the ABC is, you know, an iconic institution related to sport in Australia. I remember listening to cricket matches from the 30s, the Bradman era, and of course, they then got involved in the Olympics, but now would tend to go to a more private consortium, like a 7 or 9 or 10.
We wouldn't be able to afford to be able to pay for the rights for the Olympics now.
No, it's interesting, your last caller, you know, it's interesting to see, because in 1976 I went to the Montreal Olympics, and I had the same thing happen. I couldn't afford as a student then to go, so I go outside the venues, and you could catch people coming out. Let's say it was a doubleheader basketball game and they stayed for the first game and left, and I would just get their tickets and go back in and watch. Of course, you can't do that now because they security check you going into these zones, and there's no pass outs, you can't go in and out. So it was a little less stressful of an era, but it helped people a lot to see the games.
Richard, Maureen spoke about the opening ceremony, but the closing ceremony was one of the significant parts of the Melbourne Games.
Yeah, because we left a legacy as a result of that, in that there was a Chinese student, John Wing was his name, came up with the idea, instead of marching in as nations to the closing ceremonies, which happens in the opening, that they mingle, they come in unified, and that was the start of a tradition which still exists today. So it's much more relaxed, the closing, and has this tradition that we gave to the games. What is interesting was a Chinese student who was studying here that came up with that idea, sent in a letter suggesting it, and the organizing committee took it on board, and that's one of the other legacies besides the, you know, the great iconic MCG and the facilities that have resulted in Melbourne since 56, including the National Sports Museum, which is in the MCG, and you mentioned earlier Betty Cuthbert. There's various Olympic athletes. There's John Landy Room. There's the Olympic Room in the MCG, and statues of athletes around, and the plaque gives all the medal winners. So it's fabulous to go on a tour of the MCG and see what's still left from 56, and of course we've modernized that whole Olympic Park era now with all the new facilities.
Richard, was the reason that he wanted to do that, for people to come in not associated with their countries but come in together, was that because there'd been some conflict?
I'm not sure of his motivation behind it. I don't know that. I've read about that, you know, the stuff that he did with it all and got accepted, and I'm not sure if it was anything, because he probably would have come up with the idea pre-Olympics and gave the organizing committee, and then they decided, let's make this change in the closing ceremonies. And the opening ceremonies, there's 10,000 athletes now in the Olympics. There's just over 3.5, I think, in Melbourne. So it's growing 3 times. But a lot of the athletes that compete early don't march in the opening ceremonies. Compete early in the
That's
games,
right. But was that, but, could that have, was that one of the reasons also it was called the Friendly Games?
Yes, well, I think that was part of the legacy, despite all those political controversies we mentioned, and the, you know, for one point in time, Avery Brundage, the U.S. president and ran the IOC, was going to take the games away from us. People might not know that, because we weren't moving along with our choice of venues, and he came out in May of the year before and was threatening to maybe move them to Philadelphia.
That's right.
But we overcame that problem, but I would think that he came up with the idea well before, and then the organizing committee took it on board and then made that adjustment.
Stuart, good morning.
I was born in Lower Hutt, New Zealand, and Norman Reed was our milkman over there, and I've often chased him down the road to get some milk, and him and Lionel August, Norman anyway, won the walking because the Russians overstepped and that sort of thing in 56.
Oh, thank you.
Yeah, I hadn't heard that one. I know they had such a strong team, the Soviets. They came out of nowhere in 52 and were so strong in a multitude of sports. They had a famous runner, Vladimir Kutz, who won a medal. I hadn't heard that walking one, so that's a new one for me.
So he was in New Zealand, Stuart?
Norman Reed was a New Zealander, but Kutz was more than 5,000 metres, as
yes.
I recall. He wasn't
yeah.
a walker as such, but the Russians were coming first and second, I think, and they overstepped and tripped, and he fell into the winning. But
excellent.
Of course, I transited through Melbourne many times, and I went to the bar for a drink a few times, and then all of a sudden I saw this huge picture up on the wall, and I thought, that's the milkman up there.
Good, thank you. The news is coming up, Richard. One of the things that I found interesting was the fact that Melbourne continued the sporting tradition, and where other countries didn't necessarily do that, but Melbourne has done it particularly well.
Oh, yes, some of them have a legacy of white elephant facilities, and just Melbourne's just done a fabulous job in that precinct. I mentioned the National Sports Museum's there. The Victorian Olympic Council holds its Pierre de Coubertin, the founder of the Games Awards in the MCG. We've got all the new venues, the Rod Laver Arena. We've got Amy Stadium. We've got the State Netball and Hockey Center. I mean, we could host the Games facility-wise and the infrastructure to get them there easily, but we've got issues of politics preventing us from doing that domestically and internationally. But just this fantastic legacy, and people that are, you know, the callers have, you know, spoken to us today, give us their stories about how, you know, we're such an iconic city. We did a research paper, Rob Hess and I, on this, and it's out there telling and what our future perspectives for holding the games. And at our university, we have an Olympic research group network, and we're trying to get that off the ground, working with the Victorian Olympic Council and our university to, you know, highlight just what a fantastic city we are in terms of our legacy of the Olympic Games.
Fingers crossed, Richard. Richard, thank you very much for joining us.
No worries.
You're listening to Overnights with Trevor Chappell on ABC Radio, and we're heading off to the next ABC News.